How to achieve happiness is one of those questions that keeps philosophers awake at night, has done for centuries, millennia even. So if you need a little happiness boost today, why reinvent the wheel? Why not see what the great minds of the past had to say on the subject? Richard Schock is a cultural historian at the University College of London. He recently published an indispensable little book called The Secrets of Happiness, 3,000 Years of Searching for the Good Life. Schock says the way we think about happiness today is a thin, watery version of what was once a deep and complex subject. What's changed?
I think what's changed is the sense that we are entitled to be happy. We have come to regard happiness as a sort of consumer product, the ultimate luxury item. And if only we just had enough money, we could go into the happiness store, plonk down our money and take it off the shelf and then take it home. And that's a very unusual, very modern way of thinking about happiness. Even Thomas Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence said, our right is only to the pursuit of happiness. We do not have a right as such to be happy, but we think we do have a right to be happy. And our immediate way of thinking about that is pleasure. We have this fantasy idea that if only we could just cram our lives full of pleasure and rid our lives of every possible pain, then we would be happy. But you know, people have been thinking about happiness for as long as humanity has been thinking about anything, for thousands and thousands of years. And the people who have thought most profoundly about happiness, whether it's in philosophical traditions or in religious traditions, those thinkers have rarely identified happiness with pleasure. It's a peculiarly modern, individual, consumerist, if you will, notion of way of looking at the good life.
Do you think that the great pursuers of happiness would agree with you in this? Do Seneca and Ghazali, do Thomas Aquinas and the utilitarians all come at this in more or less the same way, even though they have different avenues that they use to pursue happiness?
That's a terrific question, which admits of no easy answer, so I'll do my best. The hardline Stoics, like Seneca, because they suffered so greatly in their life, had a really kind of refugee or escapist sense of happiness. They wanted to flee from the world and live entirely in their mind, to shield themselves from whatever was happening. So in such harsh, hard circumstances, you can imagine that someone might think that the secret of happiness really is to withdraw from the world.
We should look a little into the contrasting views. The Epicureans, for instance, the word itself now almost equates with pleasure, with personal pleasure, whereas Epicurus, as you note in The Secrets of Happiness, was not actually interested very much in his own personal pleasure.
It was just the reverse. You talk about words that have come to mean almost the opposite of what they meant originally. Epicurean is one of them. We think of people who are just gluttons who can't get enough of sensual pleasure. But old Epicurus himself famously said to a friend, "Send me a morsel of cheese so that I can have a feast." And his view was that if you ratchet down your expectations for what you need in life, for the pleasures and the good things, if you can just curtail them, rein them in, you're actually going to be much happier because your threshold is much lower. So when those things do come along, you'll be really happy. If your threshold is very high and you're expecting one intense moment of pleasure after another, well, of course, you're going to end up disappointed because nobody has that kind of life. So to some extent, lowering, moderating your expectations is one of the keys to becoming happy.
And John Bentham of the utilitarian philosophy believed almost exactly the opposite, that it was that happiness was pleasure minus whatever pain you experience.
Exactly. He called it the philosophic calculus, the happiness equation. You add up all the pleasures in your life, and then you subtract all the pains in your life. And what's left over, if it's a positive number, is happiness. If it's a negative number, is unhappiness. If only it were that simple. But of course, the equation is impossible to effect in real life. And I think the sense that the equation doesn't work is yet another reminder that pleasures really cannot be the basis of happiness for a couple reasons. And the most obvious one is that pleasures fade.
If Bentham and the utilitarians were to be applied to the life of Seneca, he would be an extremely unhappy man, wouldn't he?
He would, by those lights. But if you read what Seneca says about his own life, he found his strength from within. And I think that's something that a lot of us can connect to, even today, thousands of years later, in entirely different circumstances. We often feel that the world hits us, assaults us with negative forces, whether it's economic difficulties or people disappoint us, our plans don't go exactly as we expect. And we feel that to some extent the world is beyond our control. And all we can control, again, is our response to it, our attitude toward it. And usually that means a little bit of detachment. Try to distance yourself from all those things. And in that detachment and that distance can come a calmness, a reflective period, a moment of meditation. Seneca would call it serenity or tranquility, that in fact is another name for happiness.
Tell me about another. Tell me about Ghazali. It seems to me that he is more of what we would call a mystic.
That's right. Ghazali was a Sufi mystic, not of the highest order, but he was very sympathetic to that movement. The Sufis were about imagination and personal experience. They thought that experience was really the high road to happiness. And for them, they defined it as an individual encounter with God. And imagination was the key because, of course, you're trying to get in touch with the transcendent, with the infinite, with the more, however you wish to define it. So it really has to come to you through imaginations, whether that's in Sufi poetry or music or the great Sufi dances of the whirling dervishes. All those things are attempts to remind us that happiness cannot be reduced to a kind of logical, linear, rational 12-step program or formula, anything like that. That becoming happy is really a kind of voyage, if you will, a way of being transported into the unknown. And that's why the mystics relied upon visions and poetry and dances to get them there, the sense of imagining what a different kind of life would be and then bringing that about within your life day to day. Again, I think that's a profound rebuke and challenge to the way we think about happiness as today. We want it all, as they say, done and dusted. We want our 12 steps, our rules, our 10 commandments of happiness. And we don't want to think of happiness as being something a bit more fugitive, a bit more elusive that requires imagination.
Richard Schock is a cultural historian at the University College of London. His book, Secrets of Happiness, is a short course in 3,000 years of thinking about the good life.